position number 16808, reel 29.
Reg Spittle's reel 29.
And he used to do this by hand, and he got this sort of a kit, a little case with all this bits of kit in what he did it with. And certain types of photographs he could colour, you see. If there was too much black, which he obviously couldn't colour, then it wouldn't make a reasonable reproduction in colour, you see. The certain ones where there was a lot of what you might say light compared to the black or dark, he could make a good job of colouring them, you see. And I had a couple of them, which the wife still got in the album somewhere, of a couple of photographs that obviously he said he could be able to deal with and make a decent job of, you see. And because the photos were glossy, and in no doubt they were sort of handled a lot, so they were greasy and that, he would first of all have this liquid in the sponge, and he would clean the surface so that it was porous, as you might say, to take the paint or whatever it was he used. And so he had quite a full-time job of that, because the personnel was changing all the time, you see. I mean, although when I went into that room there was a couple of dozen of us, after a time there'd still be a couple of dozen of us, but there'd perhaps be half a dozen posted, and half a dozen strangers will come in, you see. And so all the time you've got personnel changing, like with people going and coming, but there was always that sort of a full room all the time with a couple of dozen of you. And so for the time he was there, he was used to do this as a sideline. And of course he used to do it for whatever, if he was, I'd forget now whether he was a heavy smoker, but if he was, he'd probably do it for cigarettes or whatever, you see. Because money you didn't have a use for. I mean, if you went into the town and there was, say, you're a jeweller and you sort of looked, you wanted to get a ring or a trinket to send home to your wife or sweetheart or whatever, he didn't want money himself, the jeweller. He would want cigarettes or chocolate or anything that could be used for barter.
Why wasn't money wanted?
Well, it was money. So with money you could only buy something. But if you got cigarettes and chocolate, stuff you could barter with, it made you more accessible to more products than money would. It's rather strange, really. And a situation arose, and my wife would tell you the same, that we never drew any money to, like, what you call wages. When it come to payday, you didn't draw any. You didn't need it. I mean, even if you went to a cinema, you go to a cinema and you give them a packet of fags, they was more happy than money, because it was something that put them in a different category of life. Something that barter, you say. And so you never drew any money. And time went on, and it got to the situation, after I got to the unit that I eventually went to at Brussels, almost the first thing that happened there, the clerk there, he said, by the way, Corporal, he said, you've got too many, what do we call them, accumulated money, you say, credits. He said, your credits are too big, he said. So I said, well, I can't help that. He said, well, he said, you've either got to do one or two things. He said, you've either got to draw some out, he said, or send it home. And my wife would tell you, I used to frequently send home, at that time, about £40 average, which then was a fair sum of money compared to today, of course. And she used to cash it. They used to send a money order of some sort. And of course, my allotment to the wife was going every week anyway. And she was sort of saving this money, like, you know, whatever. And so we used to, your credits got too high. It was happening all through the forces.
Was she using money, or was she bartering in England?
Oh, no, it was just cash. So she would put it in the bank.
But was a barter system also in operation in England?
In England? Oh, yes. Anybody that had got the facility for goods, you know, like say about the Americans with the silk stockings and all that sort of thing, these spibs, as they called them during the war, That's what they traded in, you see, black market goods. And that was rife in England, in normal civilian life, this black market, you see. And on the continent during the war, I mean, it was a way of life. You know, money was really an unnecessary thing. People amongst themselves found it was more practical that you had, well, with Gaston on, no doubt, him being a shoemaker, the reason he was apparently living well with bread and meat and stuff like that is because he was able to mend somebody's shoes, and he didn't want money. If he mended the butcher's shoes, it'd be all right for meat. If it was a grocer, it'd be all right for a bit of buckwheat butter or lard or fruit, stuff like that, you see. And this was a barter system. It was a barter life. It had gone back to the old days. And so money you didn't need, so you never drew any. So your credit, so if you didn't draw your week's money, it's credited to you. And it accumulates, you see. And it gets to the point where if something isn't done, even somebody sitting upstairs in a stuffy office, totally out of touch with the war, who is connected with the financial side of the war, are going to realise that here we've got a private soldier here and his credits are so many hundreds of pounds. What's gone wrong? And they're going to investigate why. So as you go back down the steps to the man on the ground, the trooper or the private, the person who deals with his money on the spot, whether it's his regiment or in our case a holding unit, you see, there's somebody there responsible for money. At that level, they have got to make sure that this situation doesn't arise, because indirectly it's going to be a case of exposure, that right down on the ground floor is a people who are not drawing money because they're living on the black market, and the people above them are also living on the black market, and it will escalate right up to the top man. And in the during the war, even the top man is involved in black market. He might be a lord or a sir or whatever, but he's still involved in black market during the war, in some case or other, you see. So to protect themselves, each step of the ladder has to protect itself. And on the ground floor, the way they do it is simply to say, look, your credits, you've got too many, so you've got to do something about it, you see. So there's only two ways you can do it. You can either draw it out into your pocket where you don't want it, or you can send it home to someone. If you're married, it's simple. You send it to the wife. If you're single, if you're a single child, you send it to your mother or your sweetheart or your brother or your sister, somebody, you see. But there's got to be an outlet for this accumulated wealth that the war has created for you in that area. It doesn't happen in England, because money's money and you spend it, you see. But when you get abroad, wherever you are, wherever the British serviceman is abroad, he lives on barter, on the black market, whether it's in the desert or anywhere. But money's no good to them. But they've got to have it because it's a wage and it accumulates, and it's got to have an outlet. So, I mean, you get a chap in the desert, he's up in the desert for, say, several months, and all those weeks or ages, he hasn't drawn them because he can't spend them. So they're credited to him. So when he goes down to Cairo for a week or whatever they used to let them go, he's either got to spend all that money and blew it on having a good time, or send some home, you see. But he must get it down. The level has got to be reduced some way or another, or otherwise a higher authority is becoming aware of the black market. And although they themselves are in the black market, they don't want the repercussions to come back and expose them. So right from the top to the bottom is black market, you see. And the only way to hide it, you don't get rid of it, you hide it by that method in the case of an ordinary private soldier. And in my case, as a corporal, you see, I mean, I was on quite a high wage, because I believe earlier on I told you the incident where when we was at Driffield in Yorkshire, and old Jack Mann, my troop sergeant, he said to me one day, he said, "Hey," he said, "we're talking in the sergeant's mess." He said, "And old Albert Coulson," and that we were talking, and he said, "There's a corporal in our squadron who draws more money a week than a sergeant." He said, and I told him, he said, "That's not possible." He said, "There is." He said, "There's a corporal in our squadron, his pay is higher than mine." And that was Albert Coulson, who was a sergeant. Of course, he was an old terrier, so we're all friends, right? So old Jack Mann said, "But he wouldn't tell us who it was." He said, "Do you know who it is?" I said, "Yeah, I know who it is." He said, "Who?" I said, "It's me." He said, "What? You get more than I do?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you don't know what I get." And I said, "No, no, I don't." I said, "Get more than you, though." And I was on 12 and 6 a day, which, if you talk to people, for a corporal to have 12 and 6 a day was big money, you see. And because I was married, I didn't pay any tax. So I was on a good thing, really. But that was all right in England, you see. But when I got on the continent, that made the matters worse in respect of my credits. My credits were going up in leaps and bounds. I was like a little millionaire sitting on a gold mine, you see. And my wife would tell you, it was a laugh in the family, you see, because they used to say, "Airflow, she was all right, you kept sending her money," you see, because I didn't want it. I was living on the black market. Everybody's living on the black market. And this was why, in this barracks, and I had been put in charge, Bert eventually went, and I still carried on in charge. And I used to say to people, "Now, anybody stopping in tonight?" Because not everybody went out, you see. Got to stop in, write letters or something. And somebody say, "Yeah, I'm stopping in, Court." I say, "Right, so you'll make sure the door's kept shut." "Yeah, that's all right." I said, "No, you're not going to go out at all," you see, because, I mean, they might want to go to the toilet, you see, or somewhere like that. So we used to make provision for that, you see. We used to have a little booking in the corner, so he didn't have the excuse to go to the toilet. Because people used to, in other doings, they'd go and try the doors, you see. Open the door, look in. And you always had to have a man out, so say, "You all right, then?" I say, "Yeah, okay, mate." "Shut the doors." "No good going in there, because there's somebody in there." "Say, can't pinch nothing in there, somebody on guard." So you always had to have a provision of somebody in that room 24 hours a day. And an incident happened to this chap who used to do the painting and the photographs. He said one night, he said, I said, "Anybody staying in?" He said, "Yes, I'm stopping in." I said, "Right, okay." I said, "So, you know the drill?" "Yeah, we're all right," he said. So that was it. And next morning, when we were sort of laying their kit out, as we used to have to lay kit out, he said, "A pair of my boots been pinched." You see, initially he just mislaid them, and he looked round and it wasn't there, you see. So I said, "Well, that's a bit funny, isn't it?" I said, "You were in charge of the room." I said, "You had a pair of boots pinched." "Well," he said, "I did have a nip eight." I said, "Well, there you are." He said, "What do you mean, there you are?" I said, "Well, you know what to do. You pinch another pair." He said, "Well, I'm not going to do that." He was one of these righteous buggers, you know. He said, "I'm not going to do that." I said, "Well, in that case, you'll have to pay for a pair then." You see, it's the only way you're going to get them. If you get a quartermaster, they're not going to give you a pair. They'll sell you a pair, you see. They won't give you one. So you only got to pinch a pair, you see, because somebody had pinched this and flogged them, you see. Out, you know, out in the town or something. And he said, "No, I'm not going to do that." He said, "I'm going to report it." I said, "You can't." "Oh, can," he said. I said, "Of course you can't." I said, "You was in charge of the bloody room." I said, "If you're in charge of the room, you have a bit of kit pinch, mate." I said, "That's up to you. You go and pinch a bit more." "Oh, no," he said. He didn't say that. He said, "I'm going to report it." So he said, "He reports it," you see. And it's really comical. These situations arise, you see. And the consequences are comical. So he goes and reports it. And next thing I know, Sergeant Major comes around, he said, Corpse Petals, Clean Fatigues. I always used to say that, you say Clean Fatigues, in case you were mucky. And they said, office, 10 o'clock or whatever time, you say. I said, what's up, Insom, are you? He said, no, we'll meet there. He said, we'll see when you get there. So when I get there, there's blokes there, you see. And the Sergeant Major marches us in. And this Major, old Tash, he said, right, he said, we have a problem. He said, nobody was on a charge, you see. He said, we have a problem. Now, he said, Corporal, he said, this person has lost a pair of boots from your room. I said, that's quite right, sir. I said, I've told him what to do, sir. I know that's not the point, he said. I understand, he said, that you are the NCO in charge of that room. I said, well, I'm looking after it, yes, sir. He said, I don't quite follow that. So I said, well, I'm not in charge, actually, sir. He said, is some Major? Some Major said, Corporal Spills, senior NCO in that room, sir. Oh, there you are, Corporal, he said. You're in charge of that room. I said, no, sir. I said, I'm looking after the room and the men's welfare in the room. I said, that is all. He said, I don't think I'm thick or anything. He said, but can you explain that a bit better? I said, it's quite simple, sir. I said, when I arrived here a long time ago, I said, we marched along the corridor and the Sergeant Major opened the door. He said, how many beds? And they said, how many beds, sir? And he said, right, you were in there. I said, and I was put into that room. I said, there was already an NCO in that room before I went in it. I said, and he wasn't in charge of it. He was just in it. I said, and that's what my position was. I was just in it. Because the Sergeant Major said, right, you six, in there. I said, and me and five others was in it. I said, I wasn't in charge of it. I said, but for the welfare of the men and the situation that domestically goes on in these barracks, sir, I undertook it upon myself to look after the welfare of the men in that room for such times as I'm here. I said, if a senior NCO is put in that room, then he can take over if he wants. But I said, I was never detailed to be in charge of that room. I said, if the Sergeant Major had inquired and told me I was in charge, I would have been in charge, sir. I said, but I wasn't. I was put in it. And I just voluntarily took the responsibility of looking after the welfare of the men in it. I said, and that's the depth of my responsibility, sir. I'm not responsible for that room. I said, I've told this man what to do. I said, we have a system, I said, in case you didn't know, sir, of making sure that the room is never empty except on first parade in the morning. I said, and in that case, if anything's stolen or lost, it can only come back on the permanent staff who are not on parade. I said, so at other times, there's always a man in that room to prevent pilfering. I said, this man's had a pair of boots pinched simply because he was in charge of the room voluntarily. He chose to absent himself from the room, during which time his pair of boots was pinched. And I told him what to do. Pinch another pair. So, of course, old Tashi said, yes, well, we don't want to encourage that sort of thing, Corporal, do we? I said, no, sir. I said, that's why we always have a man in charge of the room when everybody else is out. I said, but as far as I'm concerned, sir, I'm not in charge of the room, I'm not responsible, the Sergeant Major never detailed me, so that's it. And the Sergeant Major said, well, you'll be in charge from now on. And I said, and so I said, right, sir. I said, that's fair enough. I said, but that doesn't get away with his pair of boots, does it? I said, that's for you to decide now. So what he's got to do, I said, because it's nothing to do with me. Yes, he said, well, I think the best thing to do to you, he said to this troop, he was a trooper, he said, is, as this is all unofficial, he said, we're just having a little inquiry, he said, you've got no option. He said, you'll either have to pinch a pair or you'll have to buy a pair. He said, and you can't take it any higher, he said, because it won't be allowed to go any higher. So that's it then. He said, off you go. And that was the end of the situation. But it was funny situations arrive in these circumstances. It was rather funny because the following week I was posted. And I got posted to Brussels. And I think, I thought since it was a good job that bloke had his pair of boots made, I think I'd have still been there. I don't think anybody wanted me. And so anyway, time was going on, as I say, and life was dreary as it was going on. And anyway, I went and saw Gaston and bid my farewells. I never saw Sid again. And I was posted to Brussels. And I went to a unit known as the Interpreters Pool, 21st Army Rear HQ at Brussels. And a funny thing happened, you see, when you went, you had to be kitted out. So you went round a quartermaster's stores and he kitted you out with everything that you'd lost when you went from your unit to the hospital, you see. Because when you went to the hospital, all I had was my small kit, as they call it, you see, which was simply your washing and shaving kit and boot black polish and stuff like that, you see. Essential stuff for a daily life. But all my other gear was left with the regiment, you see. And as far as I was concerned, that was lost. I mean, they were somewhere else and I was down in Bruges. So the first thing you do, you go and get kitted out at the quartermaster's, and then you go to the medical officer and have a medical, and then you'll collect your papers from the office, a travel warrant, and off you go to whatever destination you're destined to go to. Well, everything seemed to happen to me at different times. And I goes round for my medical, and he inspects me. Drop your trousers, arms up, turn round. Yes, you're fit, you're breathing. And he said, right, looked at my paybook, inoculations, you see. And it seemed I was due for me tetanus and me TAB, you see. I think it was two tetanus and three TABs, I think it was. Something like that. Either two or one or three or the other, or one or the other and two or the other. But anyway, I think it was two and three. So anyway, he gives me these injections, you see. And by now, in the war, they just stuck them in as if you was a pig. And they didn't even change the needles. They used to put the same needle in and change the body of the syringe. You unscrew it, leave the needle in, you see. You're standing there with this needle while he's holding it. He unscrews that, picks the next one up, screws that on, puts that one in, unscrews that, picks the next one up, puts that in. And I had five injections in the same needle, which was already in my arm, you see, instead of having five separate sticks. And of course, you've got no excuse duties or anything by then, because you've become immune to it. And see, when the war first started and you had injections of any sort, whether it was vaccination or anything else, you was always excuse duty, you see, for 24 hours to recover from the shock of it. But by now, after sort of 6 years, you'd become immune to being stuck. And so that's what they used to do, you see. And then, having had that done, I put my coat on. I was just coming out of the room, and the orderly said, excuse me, sir, he said, this corporal's due for his vaccination booster. Well, when you had a vaccination, you had a booster every 5 years, you see. Well, I'd had mine done early 1940, and now it was in 1945, so I was due for me booster, you see. Now, I'd already had five inoculations, and he sticks me vaccination booster in, so that was six I'd had. And then they gives me travel warrants and everything, puts me in the truck, takes me down the station, and bungs me on a train, which was absolutely packed. I don't know why, because it seemed that the whole population of Belgium was on the move. It didn't matter if it was a tram or a train or a bus, it was always full, packed with people. You never got on one when there's only two or three people. It was, everything was, all transport was always full. I gets on the train, And of course, I had a bit of an argument when I left the barracks, because one of the things was you're supposed to collect this rifle in 50 rounds. So I went round the armourer and asked for my pistol. And of course, the armourer said, sorry, he said, one rifle, 50 rounds, they are, corporal. I said, sorry, I'm not signing for that. He said, well, that's what you'll have. I said, I won't. I said, I brought a pistol in and I'll take a pistol out, or nothing at all. He said, every person leaves with a rifle and 50 rounds. I said, I'm not taking a rifle or 50 rounds. I said, I've got the number of my pistol. I knew this wouldn't happen, you see. I said, and I shall be writing to my colonel of the 1st Royal Tank Regiment to inform him, to inform the regimental armourer where that missing pistol is, or should be. I said, that's in your armoury. He said, don't talk bloody daft. I said, I'm not talking daft. I said, if I don't take my pistol, I don't take nothing. I said, and I shall write to the regiment to tell them where that gash pistol's gone, and you'll get it. Because this was what was happening, you see. They were bringing them to these officers because it looked a bit more convenient and a bit posher, I suppose, when they socialised with a pistol on the belt rather than a rifle, you know, sort of thing. So anyway, I left Bruges with no personal weapons. I refused to take the rifle. And they didn't push it because they was in the wrong, you see. So I was allowed to break the rule. Anyway, it takes me down the station, and I'd had these 5 inoculations and my booster and for my vaccination. And I gets on the train, I puts my kit down because I got all my kit bag and everything. I sits down and the train was packed. I couldn't get a seat, so I was in the corridor. And I sits down, and the last thing I remember was putting my kit down and sitting down, and with these shivers in the passage all around me. And I went completely out like a light. I didn't go to sleep, I just went unconscious. And when I comes round, of course this Sibby chap who was there, he thought I'd gone to sleep. I suppose he thought he's a happy man. He just sat down and gone to sleep, not a care in the world. And when I came round, the train's standing still, and I sort of opened my eyes and blinks and looks round, and in a bit of a daze, so looks round, taking stock. I looks up at this chap, I said, oh, I said, I must have dozed off. I said, haven't we moved yet? And most people seem to understand the English. He said, oh, we're at Brussels. And I've been unconscious all the way from Bruges to Brussels. It was these inoculations and this vaccination thing I'd had. And they thought I was asleep, I suppose. And we're standing outside Brussels, about half a mile, in a sort of a complex of train lines and trains and carriages standing about. And I said, what are we waiting for, like, you know? He said, and it just shows you that the country was a comic, it was chaos. He said, the driver's gone for his breakfast. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, he lives across there. And the timetables of the trains were so chaotic that this bloke, this driver of this train, had stopped the train half a mile outside Brussels, gone across to his house to have his breakfast before he drove us into the station at Gare du Nord. And I thought, Christ, what a crazy country we're in. And anyway, I gets into the station in the Gare du Nord in Brussels, and it was evening time by the time we gets in and gets out of the station, and I gets round to the PRO and books myself in and all that, you see. So he said, right, he said, well, I'll get in touch with your unit and see what they're going to fetch you. Well, as I found out, this unit was only a unit in name. It was very, it was all odds and buds. They were all downgraded personnel, like myself, you said, all odds and buds. All different regiments and different stages of categories. And so they put me in the barracks in Belgium, in Bruges. And the barracks was named St. Jean Barracks.
In Brussels.
St. Jean Barracks in Brussels. Whether they're still there or not, I don't know. Very big barracks. And they didn't fetch me. That day I was there all night. I was there the rest of that night, all the next day. I was there for 24 hours, that sort of thing. And in the mess hall, what they got, there was all these, round the walls, all the way round, there was like in panels. You had like a half of a beam in the wall, well, from the floor to the ceiling, and then there'd be another one. So you had panels all the way round the room. And the Germans, when they were in occupation, they'd obviously had an artist. And you always had artists, didn't matter what the forces they were, you always have artists. And in colour, life size, in each panel, it depicted a part of the song of Lili Marlene in German, all the way round the dining hall. And in each panel was life-size figures of soldiers